the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take 2. Me, Martinez. Los Angeles is voiding almost 2 million minor citations and warrants. We'll ask L.A. City Attorney whose burden will be eased more, homeless folks or the clogged up courts. Plus, a while back we heard how microplastics were discovered for the first time in Lake Tahoe. Now, while it might not be a surprise that lots of microplastics were also found in the San Francisco Bay, how it got there might have you thinking about ditching your car for good. It's all ahead on Take 2. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Martinez. Happy October 3rd to you. I hope your day is so fetch. Yes, Regina George, I'm still trying to make fetch happen. You can throw me in your burn book if you want. Coming up, we're going to speak with the head of L.A. County Public Health about a new flavor tobacco ban. Plus, we're also going to hear about an unusual source of microplastics in the San Francisco Bay, car tire dust. That's coming up in about half an hour, so stay with us. But we're going to start with an eye on L.A. County, an announcement that could benefit many of its nearly 59,000 homeless. L.A. City Attorney Mike Feuer, District Attorney Jackie Lacey, and Police Chief Michael Moore said Wednesday that they will void nearly 2 million minor citations and warrants. It's a move that could bring relief to thousands of homeless or low-income people who have been repeatedly ticketed or arrested for minor infractions.
Most are for some violation of the vehicle code, but that includes like pedestrian walking against a don't walk sign. It could include jaywalking, things like failure to provide insurance, having an unregistered vehicle.
City Attorney Mike Feuer spoke earlier to Take 2.
A lot of the offenses are offenses that have been committed by people who are very, very poor. Because if you have the ability to pay, then you're going to pay. Because the adverse consequences of not paying are severe.
For example, failure to appear in court on a citation can turn a $100 ticket into a $300 ticket. Now, for his part, City Attorney Feuer recalled or wiped out nearly 150,000 city warrants and moved to dismiss about 800,000 pending citations, all of them over 5 years old. So during our conversation, I asked him what this means for people who have citations or warrants on their record.
So we did two things yesterday. One, we moved to eradicate these old, stale, minor infractions for very, very minor offenses. On the other hand, yesterday, we accompanied this with the announcement of what we call the Fugitive Misdemeanor Recovery Program. This boils down to the fact that while we got rid of 100,000 warrants yesterday that pertain to low-level minor offenses, there are offenses for which people have outstanding warrants and should be brought into custody. So we're focusing resources on the most serious, violent offenses.
But will the LAPD still cite homeless people the way they've been citing them in the past?
Well, that you'll have to ask LAPD. But for example, I have the view that it ought to be the case that there is some distance between homeless encampments and newly established homeless shelters or schools. The council is grappling with whether to put that rule in place. Were the council to do that, I think it's very important to have that rule enforced. There are strong reasons not to have homeless encampments immediately adjacent to schools or newly constructed homeless shelters. That enforcement is not designed to be punitive, but people who would violate that rule, were it to be adopted, should move where they are. And the police should be involved in enforcing a rule of that nature. We have this tremendous homeless crisis, but my view is we should at the same time be able to adopt an urgent, intense approach to getting people the services and housing they need, while at the same time assuring that basic rules on the sidewalks we all share are enforced.
Is issuing citations an effective way of changing their behavior, considering all the citations that have been piling up over the years?
It depends on the situation. It might be in some cases, might not be in other cases. But the alternative to not taking any action to enforce basic norms on our street is the city becomes next to lawless, and we can't have that. I think it's important to strive to do that, which is why, for example, our homeless court program, where we say to individuals who've been issued a recent citation, if you get connected to homeless services that will benefit you, we will help you get rid of that citation, is a good example of how enforcement can help change behavior for the better.
We're talking to L.A. City Attorney Mike Feuer. Now, we're going to be talking to civil rights attorney Carol Sobel after this. Her criticism is that wiping doesn't go far enough. She said that all failure to appear in minor citations should be removed removed from the books. Why are more recent offenses not included in this voiding of citations and warrants?
Well, because the more recent offenses, there may be an ability for that person to take some positive step toward being accountable during that thing. There may be an ability for us to prove up something, the system to prove up an offense that is not stale like the other ones are. And again, where Carol and I may differ is with what I just said. I think that even as we move to provide more shelter and services to homeless people on our streets, we do need to be sure that basic norms on our shared space, on our public sidewalks, are enforced so that their sidewalks are safe and accessible for everyone.
Now, how will you notify people whose records have been cleared?
That process is still underway, and I'll have more information about that soon.
What other systemic changes are you considering in the near future? I know, for example, San Francisco stopped issuing bench warrants for no-show defendants.
Yeah, the one thing that I want to emphasize is the shift from warrants for old minor infractions to the enforcement of warrants for serious violations. We've just initiated that program with LAPD. It's a really important program. There have been like a million warrants more in the system, and it's hard to separate wheat from chaff when that's the case. So the first step is to really effectively implement this approach that gets people who have outstanding warrants and serious violations into custody to protect all of us. I want to see that being effective as the next meaningful step.
All right. City Attorney Mike Fuhrer, who's recalled nearly a million old warrants and infraction citations, part of a countywide effort to remake a system that has sent many people to jail. City Attorney Fuhrer, thanks a lot for making the time.
Always, A. Thanks so much.
All right. For more on how this move to clear citations and warrants will affect L.A.'s homeless population, we have Carol Sobel. She's a civil rights attorney who's won several lawsuits against the city over homelessness issues. Carol, welcome back to Take Two.
Thank you.
Now, this has been hailed as something that could benefit the homeless who tend to incur these minor citations. But you have argued, as mentioned, that this move to dismiss citations over 5 years old is not a big enough step. Why?
Well, it's not a big enough step because the city has engaged in intensive efforts to cite the homeless on this failed theory that if you give somebody a criminal citation, you will somehow get them into services. There are a number of failures with that assumption. The first is the city doesn't have services to offer people. We are now 3 years into HHH, 2 years into Prop H from the county, and we still have the same situation. Let me give you an illustration.
But isn't dismissing the citations at least better than not dismissing them?
Oh, absolutely. But for homeless people on the street now, since they only go back, they're only dismissing before 2014, it will really not have a considerable impact. It will impact perhaps the number of citations that they have, but they're still going to have citations for the last 5 years. Those aren't being disturbed at all by any of the efforts by the district attorney or the city attorney. So they still have failures to appear. They have multiple citations for the same kinds of enforcement efforts that the city and the county are now saying shouldn't be the focus.
And Fuhrer said the reasons officials are not dismissing all minor citations is because law and order still needs to be maintained. What's your response to that?
Law and order isn't maintained by this. It wasn't maintained by having tickets that went back 20 years. Law and order will be maintained when this city provides people a place where they can be. And I heard Mike Fuhrer's comments about norms. The norm has to be that everybody in our society deserves a roof over their head. And when we leave people with no alternative but to live on the streets, it's a little difficult to talk to them about norms. And so I have a moral objection and a logical objection to that kind of argument, because you're basically putting all of the fault on homeless people who don't have any other place to live.
We're talking to civil rights attorney Carol Sobel. Carol, critics have called these types of citations, quote-unquote, debtor's prison. How have you seen this play out with your clients in particular?
Well, for our, you know, let me give you an example. We went into court last week for someone who had $800 that they owed because, if you recall, in California, the courts were piling fine fees on top of fees on top of fees because they needed a way to fund the courts. So you could go in with what was originally a $75 fee and walk out with a $700 fine that you owed. So we had people who were homeless. We went in last week for somebody who had gotten off the street, was living in housing now, and had already paid down half of that, paid like $389, could not pay anymore, couldn't pay their rent, buy their food, and pay this charge. We went into court. We convinced the court that they could not pay this, and the court actually refunded the original $389. This is a person who's back on track. And so if our focus is getting people back on track, then that's what we should do and not use the criminal justice system to get them there. A debtor's prison doesn't get anyone out of debt.
Carol, one other thing. When it comes, and you mentioned how you were in court, do you think this move will affect the volume of cases going to court and how many people wind up in jail?
It won't affect it for us because they're still going to do enforcement. And I can tell you that when we go in now, we don't see very many failures to appear that go back 10 years, mostly because we've been doing this for so long. We've had these two free legal clinics that we do, one on Skid Row and one on Venice, and we've been doing them for over 5 years at this point. So we've cleared a lot of those backlogs. But every week or every month when we do these, and we'll be doing another one on Sunday, somebody comes in with three or four failures to appear. And they are within this time frame that they've left.
That's civil rights attorney.
Going out, and just one quick thing.
Sure, sure.
They're continuing to cite people and arrest people. They're just going to have more failures to appear because we know people don't show up if they can't pay. That's what I just heard Mike Fuhrer say.
Civil rights attorney Carol Sobel sharing her take on the move to e-citations and fees impacting homeless folks in L.A. County. Carol, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Staying with homelessness, the number of people living on the streets in California is often labeled as a public health crisis. But for those experiencing it, homelessness is a personal health crisis, multiplied more than 100 times over statewide. Our California Dream Collaboration is looking at solutions to some of the problems facing the state. KPCC housing reporter Matt Tinoco explains how outreach workers are addressing some of those health needs.
It's a hot September morning, and I'm walking down a street in Venice, Los Angeles, with Dr. Coley King.
So here's Third and Rose.
It's a sprawling, block-long homeless encampment with maybe 30 tents under the beating late-morning sun. King's one of the doctors in L.A. County who practices what's called street medicine.
These patients are very sick. These patients die very young. They need medical care. Let's get better medical care to them, and let's give them a better medical home that they can come into.
King works out of a nearby medical clinic that he refers all his patients to. Living on the street shaves 30 years off a person's life expectancy. The median age of death outside is about 52. The goal of street medicine is to proactively include people in a healthcare system that's otherwise inaccessible until they hitch a ride in an ambulance to the ER.
And how are you feeling now on these medications?
I love these medications because I'm not tired.
Shonda Thornton has been on several of those expensive hospital trips since she was diagnosed with congestive heart failure back in January.
How do you feel when you walk a block or two?
I feel fine. I can walk all the way up to the 99 cent store and back.
She's in her 40s and has been in the hospital more than not this year.
September is the first month that I haven't.
Shonda's condition would be challenging even if she wasn't homeless. She was given a defibrillator vest and instructions to always wear it, but it malfunctions as she sweats through the summer living inside her nylon tent.
It was saying that I was having a heart attack, but I was just really perspiring a whole lot. So
she keeps the vest in its box in a shopping cart beside her tent. She doesn't have a place to charge it either.
It's like a pain in trying to keep it going.
So Dr. King works a compromise. Stay on her meds, get checked up in the clinic every now and then, and make sure her encampment neighbors know to call 911 if they see her in trouble. For Dr. King, the goal is to ensure Shonda has access to ongoing medical care that keeps her out of the ICU.
Street medicine has been a vehicle to stop the merry-go-round a little bit.
Corinne Feldman is a USC researcher who studies health outcomes for homeless patients. Reducing the merry-go-round trips in and out of the hospital by homeless people is basically the main reason there's more medical practitioners working on the street everywhere in the state than there ever has been before. LA County has almost 40 teams on any given weekday, reaching homeless people where they are.
There's a multitude of reasons why they might legitimately want to access that care, but they legitimately cannot.
Research shows that street medicine can encourage patients to more regularly seek medical attention. That can lead to reduced ER visits and greater overall trust between patients and homeless outreach providers. The reality is, though, people are going to be on the street for the foreseeable future. King says Californians need to look beyond the garbage and the tents and to really see the people out there who are struggling to survive.
The pitfall of labeling it a public health crisis, it becomes a reactionary, not in my backyard issue, where it doesn't need to be that. That's not what this is about. This is about the individuals who are sicker than the rest of us and are dying sooner than the rest of us.
That is, the squalid conditions on the street are mostly a risk for those who live in them, not so much the rest of us. As for Shonda, when it comes to getting off the street, she's actually doing better than most.
Right now, I have a voucher. I'm searching for housing.
A public housing voucher is a major step towards finding a home. The next is actually locating somewhere to use it. Her problem is just that she's been sick, though she's had several appointments to meet with property managers.
Every time I had an appointment or something, I would be in the hospital.
Which means her voucher is now close to expiring. Dr. King's job is to make sure she stays on her meds, stays out of the hospital, and actually has time to find a place to live. The street is no place to heal.
You can work on it. This is certainly a place to start working, but to fully heal out here, I don't think it's possible.
But it's the only place Shonda has to start. From Los Angeles, I'm Matt Tinoco.
A little while back, we heard how for the first time, microplastics were found in the pristine waters of Lake Tahoe. Now, that freaked a lot of people out because, well, it's a lake, and most people thought microplastics was more of an ocean thing. Now, while it might not surprise you to hear that a lot of microplastics are in San Francisco Bay, how it actually got in the water might be the last straw for you to ditch your car for good. That's ahead when Take Two continues in only 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. The LA County Board of Supervisors voted Tuesday to ban the sale of flavored tobacco. The move comes 2 weeks after Los Angeles City Attorney Mike Feuer recommended that the city also ban its sale. Now, the concern is over young people picking up the habit of vaping because the flavors are like mango and mint. But also in recent months, hundreds of people around the country have become sick with a mysterious lung illness that's related to vaping. For more, we have Dr. Barbara Ferrer, Director of the LA County Department of Public Health. Doctor, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, just to start, for listeners who do not smoke, explain vaping and what's known about whether it's safer or not than traditional cigarettes.
Vaping is a method of actually turning a liquid into an aerosol or vapor that then users breathe in. And e-cigarettes are what the electronic devices are called that will heat this liquid. Most of the time, e-liquid contains nicotine. One of the concerns that we have is, you know, nicotine is highly addictive. And when there's, in particular, flavoring attached to the nicotine, it can make it quite appealing for young people to start vaping, not realizing that what they're vaping is actually a product that can cause their brains not to work as well. It can cause anxiety. It can raise your blood pressure because it does contain nicotine. And most importantly, it's highly addictive, which means that you can then end up, you know, developing a habit where you need to vape.
Yeah, that appealing nature that you mentioned, is that what it makes a lot of health officials be concerned about this?
Yeah, well, we're concerned because it often contains a whole set of chemicals besides the nicotine that can also be damaging. I mean, nothing suggests that sort of heating up heavy metals, heating up what sometimes are cancer-causing chemicals, heating up oils and then inhaling them into your lungs is actually healthy. We've had no testing to indicate that this is, in fact, a successful cessation device. It's not licensed as a smoking cessation device. So you know, there's just tons of areas where, from a public health perspective, you would say, this isn't a good idea.
Do we know, though, doctor, if there's a connection between flavored tobaccos and this mysterious vaping illness that's already killed a couple of people in California and caused 100 others to be hospitalized?
We're not sure what part of vaping is actually causing people to get severely ill and, as you noted, in some cases die. You know, up to 17 people have died now from vaping-related illnesses. What we do know is that there's no single product or no single compound that's been associated with all of the deaths and all of the illnesses, which is where the alarm is at this point. You know, we can't really say, oh, it's the chemicals that are used in the vaping devices, or this is really just associated with cannabis. As a matter of fact, from our data in California, we know it's not just associated from cannabis. We have many cases of people who have just really used an e-cigarette as a nicotine delivery system.
We just saw today, USA Today, citing Mayo Clinic research, reported that toxic chemical fumes may be to blame for these vaping illnesses. Is that something your agency is aware of or looking into?
You know, I think we're very aware of the study that was done at the Mayo Clinic. They really did biopsies on 17 samples from lungs where people had been afflicted with a vaping-associated lung injury. And the data was alarming. It showed that what you look at when you look at the lungs is something you would normally see with a chemical burn or an exposure to high levels of toxic chemicals. We appreciate that research. It really will help us better understand what components of vaping we need to pay attention to and look at to see how they're contributing to what at this point is a dangerous epidemic of illness.
We're talking to Dr. Barbara Ferrer with the L.A. County Department of Public Health. Now, California state law prohibits the sale of tobacco products to anyone under the age of 21, but kids who are far younger still manage to buy it, along with a lot of other things that they probably shouldn't be buying. What can be done about that, doctor?
I mean, one of the things we do with the sheriff in L.A. County is we actually use decoys that will go in as part of a routine compliance check and see whether or not there's the sale to underage youth. Unfortunately, this past year, we found that one in four of the venues that were being inspected for compliance were in violation. That is, that they were selling to an underage person. They were selling tobacco products. You know, that's alarming. It makes it very hard to ensure that young people don't have access to tobacco products. But we also have to make tobacco products less appealing to young people, and we have to make sure young people and their families are well educated about the dangers associated with these products.
You know, anytime there's a ban on anything, there's always a debate back and forth about whether a ban is really the right way to go. And in this case, critics say that a ban would drive smokers to the black market, where the products are unregulated and often unsafe. And the CDC just found last week more than 70% of vaping illnesses were related to black market marijuana vapes. What do you think, doctor, when it comes to banning and having people maybe get their options somewhere else?
The first thing I would point out is there hasn't been a ban and people are still purchasing on the black market. So a ban in and of itself doesn't really create the black market. The black market's already there. I think the onus is on all of us as parents and adults to make sure that we understand clearly what the dangers are and that we're communicating that information. I don't think that there's any reason why you would sell a product that you know really can cause serious illness and death at any level of use. You know, people have compared this to alcohol. This is not alcohol. There's absolutely no dose of tobacco products that's safe.
Well, let me bring this up then, because a lot of vaping advocates say that flavored tobacco has helped them kick a more dangerous traditional smoking habit. One listener, Alex Gudich, wrote this to us. They helped me quit smoking after we found out my wife was pregnant. A godsend to finally get off the stinky sticks after 15 plus years of smoking. I feel infinitely better, exercise more often, have better self-esteem. My plan is to use them as a nicotine replacement and then taper down. What's your response to that?
My response is that the FDA approves all smoking cessation devices. And anybody is able to submit to the FDA a product that they think helps people quit smoking and have it approved as a smoking cessation device if, in fact, that's what it does. So, you know, we would urge any manufacturers of devices where they think that these can serve as smoking cessation devices to go through the process and have them, in fact, licensed and regulated as a smoking cessation device, which means that then people can feel assured that they're actually purchasing something that will, in fact, safely help them quit smoking.
You know, wondering, Doctor, as an L.A. County health official, what's your perspective on flavored tobacco bans? Is it necessary to safeguard public health this way?
I absolutely believe that we need to remove all flavorings from tobacco products. I think that will limit the number of people who will use tobacco products and limit the number of people who will be enticed into picking up a habit without realizing how dangerous it is.
That's Dr. Barbara Ferrer with the L.A. County Department of Public Health. Doctor, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
When we talk about the downsides of driving, it's usually about traffic or air pollution, but a new study finds there's another risk: tiny car tire fragments that end up in our waterways. Researchers spent 3 years studying microplastic levels in and around the San Francisco Bay, and they found that rainfall washes more than 7 trillion, that's 7 trillion pieces of microplastic into the bay every year, some of the highest levels seen to date. Joined now by Dr. Rebecca Sutton. She's a senior scientist at the San Francisco Estuary Institute and lead author of this study. Dr. Sutton, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
All right, doctor, so break down these results for us, because 7 trillion pieces of microplastic sounds awful.
It surprised us, too. This was a unique finding from our study. Previous work has not addressed this urban stormwater pathway, all the rainfall that rushes through our city streets and into creeks and storm drains, where it's discharged directly to our bay.
Now, if I'm not reading this wrong, these particles, are they breaking down or are they just breaking apart?
Well, plastic is persistent, right? It lasts for a very long time in the environment. So larger plastic items break down into smaller plastic items rather than disappearing.
So even if they're not causing any visible harm right now, it's still something that needs to be addressed eventually.
That's true. We aren't quite sure yet of the toxicity threshold, the level above which harm could occur. But because we're making more plastic and more is getting out into the environment, we do think this is a problem that deserves attention now.
Now, doctor, let's take a step back for a second. When we talk about microplastics, define what microplastics are. Where do they come from?
Microplastic is defined as little bits of plastic smaller than 5 millimeters. So a good analogy is smaller than a kernel of popcorn. Some you can actually see, but many are too small to see. Now, they can come from a whole variety of sources. So one of the sources in stormwater that we suspect is vehicle tires. So as our tires are moving along on the road, they are gripping the road, there is abrasion, and little bits of tire can fall off onto the road. Now, another source can be textiles, our synthetic clothing, for example. There's a whole variety of sources because we use plastic in so many ways.
And then when these microplastics wind up in the water, is that where they come into contact with some of the critters that live in the ocean?
That's correct. All kinds of organisms can eat these very small plastic particles because they are so tiny. So we can have very small organisms consuming plastics out of the surface water, out of the water column, and down at the bay bottom.
We're talking to Dr. Rebecca Sutton. She's a lead author of a new study that found high levels of microplastics, especially from car tires in the San Francisco Bay. Doctor, is car tire dust any worse than other types of microplastic?
Well, that's a tricky question. Unfortunately, the impacts from plastic can be modified by the chemical composition as well as the size of the microplastic and the shape. So it's really tricky at this point to figure out what's the most harmful sort of plastic and at what levels.
Was there a point, doctor, where all of you looked at each other and said, oh my goodness, there's a lot of this microplastic in San Francisco Bay?
Yeah, this was a pretty eye-opening study. We had actually conducted a pilot study back in 2015, and that's what led to this effort. So we had a hint that there might be some issues here. in the Bay. But this study really grounded that work and really opened our eyes in particular to this urban stormwater pathway.
You know, Doctor, when it comes to cars, we always talk about transitioning from gas-powered vehicles to electric ones. Ultimately, though, even the electric ones will have to be on four rubber tires, parts of which it sounds like will eventually be in the water. What's the solution to that? Is it just trying to get out of our cars and try to maybe figure out other ways to get around without that many cars on the road, leaving those particles in the road?
I think that would be a great ultimate way forward for our whole society for any number of reasons. We also see another potential solution for the particles in the roadways and from the stormwater in our urban landscapes, and that is this nature-based sort of filtration approach that's called green stormwater infrastructure. And it's basically things like rain gardens, which channel road runoff through engineered matrices so that the microplastics can be caught up by the different layers of sediment. And so this is something that's already being used for regulated contaminants like metals and PCBs. And we see that it could be effective as well for microplastics.
These were some of the solutions that you presented to policymakers. Is that one they discussed? And tell us about some of the others.
Oh, sure. Our partners in the study were the Five Gyres Institute, and they developed a solutions document drawing from all the data we generated for this study. And so three of the really top-level solutions that they identified were, first, reducing our use of plastic, and in particular that single-use or disposable plastic. So the second solution that they identified was this green stormwater infrastructure. And then the third solution that they really identified as one of potential interest would be attaching filtration devices on washing machines, because when we wash our clothing, they can generate a lot of microplastics. You know, that abrasion in the wash cycle can cause a lot of shedding of these tiny fibers. And if we can filter out some of these fibers before they get into our wastewater, then we won't have so much microfiber in wastewater.
That's Dr. Rebecca Sutton. She's the lead author for a new study that found high levels of microplastics, especially from car tires, in the San Francisco Bay. Dr. Sutton, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
In the 1920s, the most powerful woman in the country was an Angeleno. She was a USC Law School grad and Assistant Attorney General of the United States. And since it was the 20s, the Prohibition era, she was tasked with enforcing laws she didn't necessarily agree with, but enforced them she did, going after rum-running bootleggers so hard the press nicknamed her Mrs. Firebrand. Coming up, get to know Mabel Walker Willebrand. That's next on Take Two. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. Amy Martinez. She was known as the First Lady of Law and was the second woman to receive the prestigious appointment of U.S. Assistant Attorney General. At one point, she was considered the most famous woman in the country. Know who I'm talking about? Because she's the topic of this week's Throwback Thursday.
California, land of romance.
There is probably no single area holding so much of charm and beauty and the good things of life as Southern California.
Once a sleepy ranch town, now home to the stars of Tinseltown, the captains of industry and over 1 million men, women, and children.
There are boys and girls from the large cities and small towns. Each brings his dreams, his hopes, and his ambitions.
And the woman we're focusing on today is Mabel Walker Willebrand. Karen Abbott wrote a book all about her called The Ghosts of Eden Park. Karen, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me, eh?
Now, right off the bat, Willebrand was an impressive woman, especially considering the era in which she lived. How did she become a lawyer in the early 1900s?
Well, Willebrand was raised on the frontier and plains of Kansas and in the Midwest, and had a very strict upbringing in which her parents instilled in her, you know, very strong values of hard work and discipline and good character. And she was raised taking ice cold baths and sort of had this very disciplined view of herself. But she was just so resourceful, and she appreciated her father speaking to her, quote unquote, as if she were a man speaking about politics and business and the world. And she really grew up believing in, you know, in this early 1900s that she, as a woman, could still do anything she put her mind to. She had a very progressive mindset.
All right. So she's not from California, but she eventually did make her way out here for her law degree. How did Los Angeles eventually become a special place for her?
Well, she moved to South Pasadena, where she served as a principal and an eighth grade teacher at Lincoln Park Elementary School. And she was also attending law school full time at the University of Southern California. And during her last semester of law school, she worked pro bono in the police courts, wielding her ferocious intelligence on behalf of exclusively female client base. She was Los Angeles's first female public defender, and she argued 2,000 cases with a particular focus on prostitution. And her work was really fascinating. She was infuriated by the idea that the prostitutes' customers, the quote-unquote the Johns, they were rarely apprehended and forced to appear in court. So she utilized this rare procedure that enabled her defendants to request jury trials, which would make the Johns' presence mandatory in court. So they had to show their faces and sort of share in the shame that the women were feeling.
We're talking about Mabel Walker Willebrand with Karen Abbott. She wrote a book all about her called The Ghosts of Eden Park. Now, let's talk about her work, specifically during Prohibition, which started back in 1920, lasted more than a decade. Her work during that time actually went on to inspire a character on HBO's show Boardwalk Empire.
Is it difficult to become a lawyer?
Not if you set your mind to it and don't take no for an answer.
I doubt it was that simple.
You're right. I started as a public defender. As you might imagine, my only clients were women.
What kind of women?
The kind who don't have any other choice.
Now, that character you heard there is Esther Randolph, who was heavily inspired by Willebrand. What was her reputation during Prohibition?
When she was appointed by President Warren Harding in 1921, you know, the administration was underestimating her. They figured, you know, Willebrand at this time was 32 years old, only 5 years out of law school, and had never prosecuted a single criminal case. You know, all of her work had been on the defendant's side. And I think it's interesting to note, too, that when she took this job, women had only had the right to vote for 9 months.
Oh, wow.
So you can imagine that everybody was very sort of circumspect about a woman wielding this kind of power, especially with a law that was not popular, as Prohibition was not. And she really had a lot working against her. Not only did she have to deal with her crooked bosses in the White House and the Ohio gang of President Warren Harding, which is also portrayed in Boardwalk Empire, the general population was finding any way they could to find loopholes and to find ways to get liquor into the illegal market and profit from this.
Now, she was really fierce about upholding the laws of Prohibition. Her personal beliefs weren't exactly in line with the law, so to speak, though, right?
Yeah, that's another fascinating thing about her. Before Prohibition was enacted, she really liked her California Clarets. She was a big wine drinker, did not at all believe in Prohibition as a viable law that could be enforced. She knew what she was up against. And yet, Willebrand had a drive about her. She always had this belief that she was selected by God for a bigger purpose. And I think it was as much to do with, you know, doing a duty for her country, even if she herself didn't believe in it. She did not like to lose. And I think that was it. It was a big challenge for her. And could she be the one to really enforce this unpopular law?
Now, what about her later years? How did Willebrand carve out work for herself in California?
Well, after she resigned from the Justice Department, she went into private practice, partnering with her old boyfriend, Fred Horowitz, who people in Los Angeles might know him as the person who built the Chateau Marmont. Willebrand actually chose all of the furniture and fabrics for the Chateau Marmont. And one of her first clients was Fruit Industries, which was an association of California grape growers who utilized a loophole in the Volstead Act that allowed for private production of table wine. So it was kind of a sort of slap in the face to her old Prohibition ally. They were very upset about this and considered her a traitor. And her response to that was, "I do not conduct my private practice in the newspapers." And she worried not about the press, but about Al Capone, who was also trying to cut a deal with a rival outfit of grape growers. So ironically, Al Capone became one of her rivals after her job as an enforcer of the law.
And Karen, how much work did she do in Hollywood, in Hollywood's infancy way back in the day?
She became a lawyer for and a friend of Amelia Earhart and Jacqueline Cochran, and her work with those women caught the attention of Louis B. Mayer. And he hired her to handle federal regulation and tax matters for MGM. And after that, a bunch of star clients followed, among them Jean Harlow and Clark Gable and director Frank Capra. And when various celebrities were accused of communist sympathies by the House of Un-American Activities, she drafted a letter on behalf of the Screen Directors Guild, which began, "Official investigations into the political beliefs held by individuals are in violation of a sacred privilege guaranteed the citizen in this free democracy."
So, Karen, I mean, really, Mabel Walker Willebrand was an absolute giant. I mean, a giant of a human being, even way back in a time when maybe there were few opportunities for women. So I think it would be very difficult to list all of her accomplishments in just this story here. But what's the impact of what she did today? What's the legacy she leaves behind?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think Willebrand really paved the way for more women to get into politics in the 1920s and in the 1930s and ensuing decades. Oftentimes, she had to hide the mistakes she was making, and she did make a few, as everybody does. And I think she was very careful to keep some of these errors to herself because she was very aware of making the road easier for women who wanted to follow in her footsteps rather than sort of put all of her own warts out there for people to judge her even more harshly than they already were. And it's sort of astounding to me that at one time, Willebrand was the most famous woman in America, except for silent film stars like Clara Bow and Lillian Gish. And today she's sort of a footnote in history, and I really just wanted to bring her back into the public eye and give her the credit that she deserves.
Karen Abbott wrote the book The Ghosts of Eden Park, which details the life of Mabel Walker Willebrand, which is the topic of today's Throwback Thursday. Karen, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right, well, since we just heard about a slice of California life in the 20s, we're going to stick with that era for a little while longer, but this next tale has a sweet and crunchy groove to it. It's about ice cream, a particular flavor that is a uniquely California creation. The smooth story of Rocky Road coming up when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. Rocky Road is one of America's most popular ice cream flavors, and it comes from California. But even though nearly a century has passed since Rocky Road was invented, there's still a dispute over just who thought up the recipe. KQED's Sasha Coca has the story.
Okay, welcome to Oakland. You are in the birthplace of Rocky Road ice cream.
It's a warm day, and I'm joining about 20 other people on an ice cream tour of North Oakland's College Avenue. Tour guide Lauren Herpick takes us to the first stop, the headquarters of Dreyer's Ice Cream.
So the real story goes, so there was a man named William Dreyer. He was a German immigrant. He loved making ice cream.
And then 1929 came along. The stock market crashed. Unemployed workers built shanty towns along Oakland's waterfront.
And so William Dreyer is like, you know, I want to make a new ice cream flavor that puts a smile on people's faces during this rocky road of life. Rocky Road becomes America's first blockbuster ice cream flavor after chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry.
The first time marshmallow was ever used in ice cream.
That's John Harrison, the guy who invented cookies and cream and some 75 other flavors for Dreyer's starting in the 1980s. His taste buds were famously insured for $1 million. He told the Rocky Road story for an oral history project with UC Berkeley, documenting the long history of Dreyer's Grand Ice Cream in Oakland. Harrison says William Dreyer used his wife's sewing shears to cut up tiny marshmallows.
The only marshmallow that was available in 1929 was the large fireside marshmallow that their wives used to cut up bite-sized. You wouldn't put a hole. It wouldn't work.
Dreyer was adapting a popular candy bar featuring chocolate, marshmallows, and walnuts. But he used almonds instead, arguing ice cream would make walnuts too soggy. In the last 100 years, Dreyer's has expanded well beyond Oakland. These days, some version of its ice cream is stocked in almost every supermarket freezer.
So now you can have your ice cream and eat it too.
Dreyer's was Nestle. Bought by Nestle in 2002, but they continue to market the brand and the claim that Dreyer invented Rocky Road. But just down the road from where Dreyer's got its start, there's another much smaller ice cream company in Oakland that also claims to have invented Rocky Road.
Chocolate ice cream coming out, layering marshmallow, walnut, marshmallow, walnut.
This is Fenton's Creamery, and owner and master blender Scott Whidden is holding a tub under a spigot churning out fresh chocolate ice cream. He's slowly adding in handfuls of marshmallows and nuts. Except he's using walnuts, just like the original candy bar.
I'm looking for equal parts. So I want that if you have a marshmallow, I want you to have maybe one or two of the walnuts, but I want you to have chocolate ice cream.
Whidden says this is the way Fenton's has made its ice cream since the 1920s. People can still watch the ice cream makers at work when they come to the parlor.
Small batch, handmade.
Out in the dining area, dozens of families are sitting in red vinyl booths, enjoying giant sundaes in old-fashioned glass dishes. Scott Whidden points to a black-and-white picture of Melvin Fenton. He was the grandson of the guy who started the original Fenton's Dairy back in 1894. And Whidden says, Melvin invented Rocky Road.
He's a visionary, forward-thinking guy, and he goes, whoa, mix-ins. So the thought process on it was, we're into the depressions, it's bad times, smooth ice cream, and then there's these bumps. It gets rocky.
That sounds familiar. Rocky Road, the Depression.
Oh my goodness.
These days, Fenton serves Rocky Road in decadent sundaes.
Look at how happy her face is. Thank you.
This is definitely my sundae when I was a child. This was exactly what we would make at home, so.
Ice cream connoisseur Amy Ettinger has come up from Santa Cruz to try the Rocky Road at Fenton's with me. She's the author of Sweet Spot, an ice cream binge across America.
It's very common in ice cream history to have these kinds of disputes. The 1904 World's Fair was when the ice cream cone was invented, and six different vendors claimed that they were the ones who invented it.
Amy says Rocky Road is the flavor of her childhood, but not this Rocky Road, the Dreyer's with the almonds.
But what's very, very interesting is Fenton's is a very beloved Bay Area institution, but it is not well known outside of the Bay Area. So regardless of who actually invented it, Dreyer's is hands down the marketer of Rocky Road. And just because the other company is the one that got the word out about it doesn't mean that Fenton's didn't invent it. There's no way for us to know.
There are lots of theories, like that Fenton's candy maker was friends with William Dreyer, and so maybe he shared his idea with both companies. And Fenton's current owner, Scott Whidden, claims that the guy who was president of Dreyer's in the 1970s admitted to him that Dreyer's had stolen the credit and used it to grow a national brand. But there's no way to prove that claim either. Then, there's the crazy theory that, in fact, Rocky Road ice cream was actually born in Topeka, Kansas. There's a recipe in a cookbook published there that predates either Fenton's or Dreyer's. It called for honey whip instead of marshmallows. Amy Ettinger says, doesn't count. Rocky Road definitely was born in Oakland. And who cares who invented it?
At the end of the day, I don't know that it matters who invented it. I mean, if both places are creating really good scoops of ice cream of it now, and they both have their little twists on it, how important is it who the original person was?
Either way, people from Oakland can have pride that it was invented here.
Exactly.
That was KQED's Sasha Coca providing us with the rich, if not 100% certain, history of Rocky Road ice cream. All right, you still have time to RSVP for the KPCC LAist Open House. That's right. You can come here and see how the radio hot dog is made. But this won't gross you out like if you were to see how an actual hot dog was made. You'll have fun doing it. Just go to LAist.com. That's LAist.com to get an RSVP. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.